Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Monday, April 24th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's show, we'll go to the Butterfly Pavilion in Westminster to hear about the work they do locally and abroad. After that, CityCast Denver speaks to an urban planner about transforming suburban sprawl into dense and walkable 15-minute neighborhoods. After the BBC News headlines, we'll hear the latest commentary from Jim Hightower. Then comes a public affair, hosted this week by Jim Williams of the Community Foundation of Boulder County. At 9 a.m., it's Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all coming up, but first, the headlines with KGNU's Benita Lee.
Another spring storm may be hitting the Front Range Tuesday and Wednesday. Blasting in from the Pacific, the system is expected to bring both heavy rain and wet heavy snow throughout the region. Up to 2 inches of rain might arrive in the Denver metro area. In the mountains and foothills, there is the potential for up to 2 feet of snow. A 6-person jury found former Aurora police officer Francine Martinez guilty of failing to intervene when her partner severely beat a suspect he was trying to handcuff. Martinez was the first person to go to trial under Colorado's 2020 police reform bill, which makes it a misdemeanor for officers to not intervene when their colleagues use excessive force. On July 23, 2021, Martinez and then-partner John Haubert were trying to take 29-year-old Kyle Vinson into custody for trespassing. Body camera footage shows Haubert pistol-whipping Vinson multiple times and choking him. Prosecutors noted inconsistencies in Martinez's statements. She said it felt like a deadly situation, but did not state this in her police report. Martinez is scheduled to be sentenced June 2nd. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser joined colleagues from other states to request a recall of Hyundai and Kia vehicles that don't have anti-theft devices. The Coalition of Attorneys General sent a letter to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration saying Hyundai and Kia vehicles made between 2011 and 2022 were unsafe because of how easy it is for thieves to hotwire them. In 2022, thieves stole over 10,000 Kias and Hyundais in Colorado alone. Social media posts and challenges showing how simple it is to bypass the car's ignition switches have gone viral. Weiser's office says the problem is a threat to public safety and makes it difficult for the vehicle's owners to obtain insurance. A court-appointed psychologist told prosecutors last week that a man charged with shooting several people in 2018 because of road rage was sane at the time of the incident. Colette Zarnicki has more.
Jeremy Webster has pleaded insanity in the case, saying that when he followed a woman's car to a Westminster dental office parking lot, then shot her and two of her sons, he felt disconnected from his body. The psychologist testified that Webster felt angry when victim Megan Bigelow almost hit his car as she moved out of the way of an emergency vehicle. Webster was reportedly concerned about getting into an accident because he had not paid his car insurance bill. Bigelow testified earlier that she had tried to reason with Webster in the parking lot. He got back into his car and was about to leave when she used her phone to take a video of his vehicle. Webster then exited the car with a gun and shot Megan Bigelow and her two children. 13-year-old Vaughn Bigelow Jr. did not survive. Webster is also accused of wounding witness John Gale, who was sitting in his truck with his 9-year-old daughter at the time of the shooting. After the shootings, Webster completed his errand at Home Depot and then returned to work on a construction project for his cousin's company. He was arrested by police after they identified his car later that day using Bigelow's video. For KGNU, I'm Colette Zarnicki.
The Northern Colorado Drug Task Force shut down an unlicensed marijuana operation suspected of distributing cannabis products nationwide. The Larimer County Sheriff's Office announced Wednesday that search warrants served to 5 trafficking operation sites in April led to the discovery of 1,000 marijuana plants, 200 pounds of cannabis-related products, tens of thousands of dollars in cash and precious metals, and firearms. Only licensed businesses can sell cannabis in Colorado, The state limits personal recreational marijuana cultivation to 6 plants per resident over age 21. Multiple agencies, including the Fort Collins Police, the United States Postal Service, and the Colorado Department of Revenue, were involved in the year-long investigation, which also discovered evidence of tax evasion. Bandimere Speedway owner John Bandimere Jr. announced Friday that the historic drag racing track in Morrison will close after nearly 65 years. Bandimere's parents opened the track in 1958. Bandimere told AP News he will close the property after the 2023 National Hot Rod Association season. As one raceway closes, another one opens. For over 3 years, the Boulder Valley Velodrome in Erie has sat empty. Last week, new Velodrome investors BVV Holdings LLC announced that nonprofit Team Colorado Cycling will run the 250-meter track as a space for competitive cyclists to train and for hosting family-friendly events. Team Colorado Cycling launched a GoFundMe campaign to raise funds for major repairs and is seeking volunteers to help with renovation projects. The KGNU News and Public Affairs Department received multiple awards this weekend. How on Earth won a Colorado Broadcasters Association Certificate of Merit in the Best Public Affairs category, while a Morning Magazine special on the one-year anniversary of the Marshall Fire won second place in the Best News Special category. That same Morning Magazine special also won an award in the Society of Professional Journalists' Regional Top of the Rockies competition. The KGNU News Department also picked up a second-place award in the public service category for the Follow the Waste series. Partly sunny along the Front Range today, then a chance of showers and thunderstorms. In Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, highs near 64 and lows around 38. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Pollinators play a key role in ecosystems around the world, but are under stress due to a number of factors. One of the nation's leading research centers into pollinators and invertebrates is right here in the Front Range. I took a trip out there last week and brought my microphone with me. Multiple busloads of school children clamor around display cases of invertebrates at the Butterfly Pavilion in Westminster. The center is the first Association of Zoos and Aquariums accredited standalone nonprofit invertebrate zoo in the world. It's also a major field trip destination for schools across the Front Range. It features invertebrates of many kinds, from tarantulas to horseshoe crabs. But as the name implies, butterflies are a central focus. And most of them live in a large greenhouse-like structure called the conservatory.
We're at Butterfly Pavilion in our conservatory where we have butterflies. We have about 2,000 butterflies flying around us of about 150 species. And it's a tropical rainforest, basically, in the heart of Westminster, Colorado. And you can come here any day of the year, except for Christmas and Thanksgiving, and immerse yourself in butterflies. They're just flying around. It's a beautiful sunny day, so they're really flying all around us right now.
That's Dr. Richard Reading, Vice President of Research and Conservation at the Butterfly Pavilion. In addition to local education efforts, like hosting regular field trips, the Butterfly Pavilion also has programs with international reach.
We are global, and we have several different entrees into butterfly conservation, one of which is we buy actually all the butterflies you see flying around here from butterfly farms around the globe. And I think there's 11 that we get them from. And those butterfly farms do a lot of conservation of butterflies where they're located, because it's obviously in their best interest to protect the butterflies and their habitat. So they're actually purchasing habitat. They're providing this sustainable livelihood source for local people, and they sell them to us. So we do that. We're actually building a butterfly farm ourselves in Sumatra, Indonesia, and the money that's generated from that project will go to support Sumatran rhino conservation. So it's a way that we can generate money or profit that goes back into conservation. So that's another way we're helping. And then we're doing conservation work such as we do in Mongolia, where we're actually working with 5 species of endangered butterflies listed by the Mongolian government. And we're trying to understand the population sizes, the population dynamics, the habitat needs. And then if we really want to know if there's any habitat that's been unoccupied that we can reintroduce butterflies into so we can increase the population levels of those butterflies. So we do a lot, Butterfly Pavilion does a lot of different projects around the world that help conserve butterflies and other invertebrates. So we work with all kinds of critters in places all over the world.
This month, the Butterfly Pavilion hosted a small group of Mongolian scientists working on Parnassus butterfly conservation. As with many other pollinators, the health of these butterflies can indicate the well-being of their ecosystems. Among the invited researchers was Dr. Gantigma Chulunbatar, director of the Invertebrate and Avian Laboratory of the Mongolian Academy of Sciences.
We have 6 species of the Parnassian genus, and then some of them it's declining, and then we are it's very important to do the research survey on those species in order to conserve them.
So why are they declining?
I would say your first reason is the harvest and also the climate change and then drought and also the overgrazing, such problem we have.
So it's important to provide some context there. So people collect butterflies like they do postage stamps and they trade them around the world. They send them in the mail to other people. And so particularly people from other Asian countries, but not so much in Mongolia, come to Mongolia, over-collect. They collect too many butterflies so they can trade them for other butterfly species to get a big collection of butterflies, much like people who collect postage stamps do. So this is a big source of decline. And then the overgrazing, of course, it destroys the habitat of the butterflies.
And why does the Butterfly Pavilion, of all the butterflies in all the corners of the globe, why would the Butterfly Pavilion invest in this particular genus of butterfly?
Well, partly because they're in trouble, and we want to help species that are in trouble, and partly because we have the landscape of Mongolia is very similar to the landscape of Colorado. So we have the same kind of grasslands in the east, mountains in the west. We have similar genera, so some of the species are really similar to what you have in Mongolia, the ones we have in Colorado. So we do have Parnassus butterflies, different species, but closely related to the butterflies that live in Mongolia. So we can bring that expertise that we have about butterflies here and bring it to Mongolia. And they have a lot of expertise that they can share with us as well.
So it's an exchange program.
It is an exchange program. And we are very lucky at Butterfly Pavilion to get support from a group called the Trust for Mutual Understanding. And they fund basically exchanges of people to increase basically conservation or cultural aspects of those places. And so programs like this where we exchange people back and forth are really helpful in generating a better kind of esprit de corps between Mongolia and the U.S. and actually help us do a better job conserving our wildlife, as well as hopefully we're doing a better job helping them do a better job conserving their wildlife.
And let's bring this full circle back to where we're standing right now. Kids are everywhere. We're inside of this pavilion, inside of the butterfly room. What's the importance of not just these high-level educational exchanges, but also bringing in children to become interested in butterflies?
We're very interested in children and education of children. In fact, Gantigma and Byram are right now working on a children's book with our education people for basically focused on Parnassian conservation in Mongolia. There's a similar book that exists. It's an interactive book where there's video and pictures, and students can use it online. And it exists for students in the United States. We want to bring that same book and adapt it to the Mongolian culture and Mongolian context, and then have that available to kids there. So at Butterfly Pavilion, we're all about education. Everything we do has an education component. And everything from PhD students all the way down to kindergartners we want to reach in terms of why butterflies are important and what we can do to conserve them.
That was Dr. Richard Reading, Vice President of Research and Conservation at the Butterfly Pavilion in Westminster. We were speaking inside of the center's conservatory, where hundreds of butterflies fly freely around a warm and humid plant-filled indoor habitat designed to replicate a tropical rainforest. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. We'll be back after this quick break. "15-minute neighborhoods" is a phrase one may hear in zoning board meetings, but what does it mean in practice? It generally refers to neighborhoods where grocery stores, leisure activities, education, offices, and access to public transportation networks are no more than a 15-minute walk away. They're designed to make efficient use of space and allow residents to be less dependent on cars. This type of mixed-use, dense, and well-connected urban design is common in older cities around the world, designed and inhabited before the dawn of the automobile. But it represents a major shift in U.S. towns and cities fueled by suburban sprawl. Some U.S. suburbs are showing that it is possible to turn that former mall into a walkable neighborhood. CityCast Denver host Bree Davies spoke with Justin Shore, a developer behind one such project in Fairfax County, Virginia.
Justin Shore, welcome to CityCast Denver.
Thank you, Bree. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I worked in urban planning randomly for 4 years. I took a weird detour. But in that time, I got to know how cities work. And I was actually just talking to my friend Yvette the other day, who's from my planning world. And I said, we're talking about this thing, Tyson's Corner. It's like a big deal. And she's like, been there. It's beautiful. So I want to start there. Why are planners so excited about what's happening with Tyson's Corner?
I would say Tyson's is in its awkward adolescence. So there is some beauty in an adolescent, but it hasn't fully matured yet. And I think that's part of what makes Tyson so exciting. It is going through that awkward adolescence to become more of a transit-oriented, walkable community. And I think what makes that even more exciting is that if you can do that in a quintessential suburban and auto-dominated environment like Tyson's, there's a chance it could be replicated in other cities. And, it takes careful thought and planning and investment, but it can be done.
So what was the challenge or what was the opportunity that people saw there or that developers saw there or folks that wanted to, you know, catalyze and build? I would love to hear. I'm just trying to get to, like, what's the push and pull with Tyson's?
The concerns that people typically have in the suburbs is, if I build a 20, 30-story building, how in the world is that not going to make more traffic? And I think providing that infrastructure allowed the conversation to be, okay, if we have 4 stations in Tyson's and we do develop at that level with that kind of density, can we sustain it? Can that happen? And so that was a bit of a collaborative conversation. Many stakeholders organized by the county that Tyson's is in, it's called Fairfax County, where there was discussion about, okay, if we're going to do this kind of rezoning that would allow the kind of density that I'm talking about, 30 stories, that's beneficial to developers. You know, developers like more density, they pay the same amount for the plot of land, whether they build 1 story or 30 stories. So if a big majority of their cost is the land value and they can capture more return from building higher, that's beneficial to them. On the flip side, the residents who live in that area, the constituents, have concerns about traffic. If you can address those concerns, then they're okay with it. But there has to be a commitment. There has to be some teeth behind it. And that's something Fairfax County did very well with something called Transportation Demand Management, or TDM. And they
I was just going to say, if you could explain what TDM is.
Yeah, in its purest form, when it comes to traffic congestion, there are supply side and demand side solutions, right? So supply and demand, like I didn't do great at economics in college, but I got that basic principle down. And the supply side is what we've done for 50 years. That is like, if you want to address traffic, you build more lanes, you make it wider, you add another road, you put in more turning lanes and traffic signals. You do everything you can to make it easier for cars to get around. And that is a solution, although we've seen more in more recent decades that that's not sustainable. It costs a lot of money. We run out of land, and there's something called latent demand. Like as soon as you build that extra lane, people are like, oh, it's free flowing. Let me go drive now. And it just as quickly as you build it gets congested. So the demand side is saying, well, let's look at the infrastructure we have and how do we get more people to use less vehicles during the worst hours when it's congested? So you can do that through a number of methods. You can get people into transit. You can get people to carpool. You can get people to work from home, as we've been doing for the last 3 years. Or you can just say, if you're going to drive, just don't drive during that absolute worst hour. Do it, you know, an hour or two earlier or an hour or two later. And that kind of spreading of the peak manages the demand. That's essentially what TDM is. Transportation demand management is either getting more people into fewer vehicles or kind of spreading the peak.
So all of this sounds amazing in theory to me, right? We're getting people out of their cars. We're building things that are close to each other and making that space more walkable. Because again, we know, if we know anything about suburban sprawl development, it's really, you can't even walk through a parking lot of a shopping center. Like there's no place for you to walk. But I know that there's still, you guys probably still got pushback. There's still got to be those NIMBY voices that say, I don't want this. How did you overcome that?
I think the biggest one, and again, if you ask in any community, you know, the not in my backyard, as you mentioned, the NIMBYs, why they don't want higher density, mixed use, walkable development, but they focus on the density and they focus on the fact that that has to mean more cars. So what Fairfax County said was, okay, we're going to make sure that every development commits to a level of trip generation, auto generation during the worst hours, and we won't exceed it. And that number that they calculated wouldn't negative, if you stay underneath it, would not negatively impact the surrounding roadway network. So what they did is they said, what's the biggest pain point for the NIMBYs? The traffic. Well, let's eliminate it. We're going to set a goal. We're going to hold the developer accountable over an extended period of time. And that should be enough to get the project approved and then demonstrate over time that it can be achieved.
I think that's probably the like not the biggest pain point in planning is like, we have a plan. I swear it's awesome. And then having to like, it has to be implemented for it to work. But it's that painful time when you have to convince people, I swear people are going to get out of their cars. I swear this, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And so, but this has been successful, right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of it, Brie. Your point is really well taken. You know, the first part of this was to say, look, a condition of your development is that thou shalt not exceed this number of trips. And if thou does, you will be fined a certain amount. And so there really were teeth behind it to make sure that it happened. And so the incentive was on the developer to perform. And that way they could guarantee to the NIMBYs, like, look, it's in their best interest. They're going to pay a lot of money, in some cases, millions of dollars if they don't perform. Now we have data from the last 10 years that says, well, not only were those peak hour thresholds managed, but they were outperformed on average by 30%. But being able to have those things prove out over time does make it, to your point, much easier to sell in the future.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see. I'm looking more into Tyson's and seeing how it works and seeing how we can look at Cherry Creek in a similar way and say, how can we tweak these little things that might get some folks out of their cars or might get folks to be able to afford to live closer, you know? I don't know. There's so many ways to think about it.
Well, and it doesn't take a lot. You know, I mean, sometimes the difference between a congested area and not is the difference of 10%.
Right.
You know, so we're not talking about changing the world. You know, changing the margins can really make a big difference.
Totally. Justin Schur, thank you so much for joining me.
Brie, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all for today's Morning Magazine. Special thanks to Benita Lee, Colette Sarnicki, Alexis Kenyon, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. If you'd like to comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesdays during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower. And then it's a public affair with Jim Williams of the Community Foundation of Boulder County. That's just after the news headlines from the BBC.